Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Ongoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. Welcome back, welcome back. Today's episode is going to be on social insurance, building better institutions, from the chapter written by Andrew Donaldson in the book Better Choices, Ensuring South Africa's Future. All right, so here we go with an excerpt from the chapter. Comprehensive reform proposals for social insurance and basic income support have been under discussion for many years, but progress has been slow. These are complex policy areas in which public and private sector institutions have complementary or competing roles, and both financing and regulatory considerations are important. Whereas current reform plans envisage entirely new institutions to replace existing arrangements, more rapid progress might be achieved by building on and enhancing existing public and private sector capacity. This chapter reviewed the Road Accident Fund, proposals for social security reform, national health insurance, and the balance between basic income support and employment creation. It suggests ways in which progress could be made through adaptation and adjustment rather than replacement of existing institutions. Okay, so hopefully that gives you some insight into what this chapter is about, at least enough for the conversation that's about to happen. But before we get into that chat, let me briefly introduce Andrew Donaldson. So Andrew R. Donaldson is a senior research associate of the Southern Africa Labour and Development Research Unit at the University of Cape Town. He is a consultant to the Association for Savings and Investment of SA, advising on social security, health financing, infrastructure investment, and macroeconomic policy. From 2001 to 2017, Andrew served as Deputy Director General in the National Treasury responsible for the Budget Office and subsequently the Public Finance Division, and as the inaugural head of the Government Technical Advisory Center, GTAC. He contributed to the work of the CATS Commission on Tax Policy, served on the Committee of Inquiry into a National Health Insurance System, and was a member of the team that drafted the 1996 Macroeconomic Strategy. He was responsible for the introduction of a medium-term expenditure framework in 1998 and led the subsequent reform of the budget process and restructuring of budget documentation. Andrew is a former member of the board of the South African National Roads Agency and a former trustee of the Government Employees Pension Fund. He continues to serve on the investment committee of the Jobs Fund. I really enjoyed this chat with Andrew because he was willing to go there with me. You know that thing where someone understands complexity and sensitivity and doesn't shy away from addressing it? This was one of those chats. So now that I've done an excellent job of whetting my appetite and hopefully yours, let's head over to the chat with Andrew R. Donaldson. All right, Andrew, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast. How are you?
Good, thank you. Nice to be with you, Marino.
Yeah, likewise. All right, so to get us started, Andrew, I thought we could engage in a very quick introductory game. Are you ready? They're just brief questions that give some insight to who you are.
Sure.
Okay. All right, so what was the first job on your resume or CV?
First job on my resume? Well, not quite sure what's on my resume, but I worked for a short while for the Chamber of Mines in a sort of labor research unit, and that gave me an insight into the sort of real tough world of mining in the late 70s, early 80s, when when the gold price spiked and there was money to spend on research, and we began the process of slowly improving living conditions in mines. But really, my first substantial job was teaching economics at the University of Tromsø, and it's a great time to learn economics because there were just three, later four of us in the department. So you ended up teaching all sorts of things and get to think about economics as a wide ranging discipline, not as the kind of narrow specialization that so many people do these days.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. That's pretty cool. How many languages do you speak, Andrew?
I speak English and Afrikaans, really, and I know a few words, of course, of having worked in the Tromsø for a while, but that's it.
Fair enough. Do you have any hobbies or skills that people don't really know about you?
Oh, dear. Am I going to have to confess all sorts of things? Yeah, I do a bit of carpentry in the garage, very amateurishly.
Hey, listen, surprise brings you joy. It's fine. We'll go with it. All right. So what best describes your work day, if there's any such typical work day?
Well, I retired from full-time, public service working in the Treasury a few years ago. So now I have a much more varied work day. Sometimes I'm doing consulting work. Sometimes I'm at the University of Cape Town. Sometimes I just take off. So I can be flexible, which is nice.
Sounds fantastic. Yeah. Are you a zero inbox person?
No, I wish I was.
All right. What's one skill that you underestimated but has served you really well in your career?
I think I've found in working in government, working in public finance, I think an ability to get on with people, listen to people, and engage with them, I think has been a huge benefit, and a complicated skill I don't really understand.
Yeah, no, definitely. I can imagine that. All right. What was the last aha moment you had, Andrew? And what was it about?
Oh, well, just yesterday, I'm working through personal income tax statistics for the country as a whole that comes from a huge administrative data set that SARS Treasury make available, and so working on big data sets like that, I had an aha moment when I started calculating just how much of an impact on our income levels comes from our pension system, and that's one of the things I talk about in this research project, particularly in the sort of top 20% of the income distribution. We have a big retirement funding industry, and it makes a big difference to income security. So I'm not sure that counts as a real aha moment, because many people sort of think I've been doing research on something, getting to grips with the numbers, you really get a sense of the magnitudes. So.
Yeah, no, if it was for you, it's valid. Right, Andrew, and the final question I have for you is, what comes to mind when you hear Africa in 2050?
Well, Africa's population is growing, so let me relate it to that sort of social security issue. Africa's population is growing fast. Africa's going to be a larger share of the world population in 2050. So there are lots of big issues. You know, will we deal with deal with water and sanitation issues adequately? But big question is, do we succeed in Africa? And I don't like generalizing about Africa, because there's so many countries, and many of them are different in all sorts of ways. But will we succeed in keeping income growing and employment growing in ways that improve living standards over time? That's the big issue. So,
are you optimistic?
I think that optimism. I think it's going to be a really tough few decades of change. I don't see an easy way forward for in a continent that's growing so fast, technology that's changing so fast, the investment that's needed is really hard to finance. So there are political battles and there are wars going on in parts of the continent. So I think there will be progress, but I think it will be sort of three steps forward and two steps backwards. It'll be a mixed and complicated trajectory.
Definitely. Andrew, thank you so much for indulging. This was great. I hope I didn't throw you off too much. All right, so for the next maybe 20 minutes, I'm going to try and capture the essence of what I think it's a wonderfully written chapter in the book, Better Choices, which is your chapter on social insurance, building better institutions. So let's start from here, right? In the chapter, you argue that while, you know, like market-based arrangements can like reward innovation and contribute to efficiency improvements, like the statutory and regulatory frameworks, right, within the country in which they operate on has powerful enabling or inhibiting effects. Can you describe some of, you know, what determines whether the effects are going to be enabling or inhibiting, and basically what the status is of social insurance right now in South Africa?
I look at the Road Accident Fund, and I look at national health insurance, and I look at proposals that have been under discussion for many years about social security reform, and in all three of those areas and in the broader area of job creation and income security in the bottom half of the income distribution, there are ideas, there are reform proposals on the table that have been talked about for a long time, but we've made little progress in implementing them. And so the main message, I suppose, of my work here is we would make more progress if we take a step-by-step approach to these reform programs. So national health insurance is a vision. The vision is of a system that is organized in very different ways from the present mix of public and private health financing and insurance and delivery. And if you try to implement the vision all at once, you just can't get there. It's just too complicated. And I could tell similar things about reforming the Road Accident Fund. It's now more than 20 years since Judge Cathy Satchwell published the 3-volume report of the Commission of Inquiry into the Road Accident Fund, which recommended a set of principles for a transition to a road accident benefit scheme, and we haven't got there yet. And we need to find ways of implementing these reforms in a step-by-step way. So that's the broad picture. Yeah. That's partly about I think taking a pragmatic approach, a realistic approach to the blend of public and private sector arrangements in this sector. And a regulatory environment, to get to your question about, you know, enabling conditions, what does one expect of the statutory arrangements? The law and public policy in insurance markets, particularly in relation to pensions, life insurance, disability insurance, and health insurance, and road accident. The Road Accident Fund is a sort of special case of that, dealing with a particular kind of insurance or risk protection arrangement. In all of these areas, private institutions will play a role, but will play a role for those who can afford them. And so if I want to simplify about what the public policy challenge is, it's to find ways of supplementing what the business sector will do. And we have a strong, big, well-capitalized financial sector that operates in all of these areas, finding ways in which public policy can ensure that private arrangements are not limited to the rich, that you find ways of subsidizing the extension of pension arrangements and health insurance arrangements to low-income households and to the population as a whole, but to do that in ways that also take advantage of the administrative capacity, the innovation capacity, the technological flexibility of the private sector. So that's the big challenge. Don't try to do it all in a government department, but also don't rely entirely on markets, because markets are never going to serve everybody in a fair way. You've got to find ways of blending public and private financing and institutional arrangements.
Andrew, from research in this space or working in this space, do you know some of the reasons why some of these conversations haven't gone as far? Because I imagine this is not the first time you're saying this, and I'm sure others may have said it. Do you know what is usually holding back these types of partnerships to find ways that the public and private sector could better complement each other to provide things like this?
I think that these are not easy areas of reform. Health financing and health insurance arrangements, regulation of the health sector, setting standards. Think of the challenges that the world has gone through during these COVID years. They're politically charged. They're often quite difficult. We're dealing with quite a lot of uncertainty. So these are not easy reforms, and they do involve particularly the health environment, so many different needs, and such rapid technological progress, so that even rich countries know that they can't afford everything that health technology makes possible, that modern medicine makes possible. And for middle-income countries, there are some really difficult trade-offs to face and challenges about rationing services, ensuring that systems are fair, taking advantage of modern medicines, modern technology, expertise, skills, and doing so in a way that doesn't limit resources to those who can afford them. So there's complexity. These are not easy areas of policy. I think we've also not made enough progress because of problems of trust. We want a reform. We want a system that's fairer. We know we're a very unequal society. There are tensions between different groups about, and there are vested interests in the business sector. There's suspicion between business and government. And although we're in a better place in terms of social cohesion and trust than we were 25 years ago, there's still a long way to go. We've still got to really find each other around the negotiating table. And I'm thinking there of the role that an organization like NEDLAC plays in bringing business, labor, government, social constituencies together to talk about reform issues. Those discussions are difficult, and we need to put more work into that.
I definitely agree on that. So I know one of the things you talk about is that, you know, there's the need for change, right? Substantial levels of change, because especially when it comes to certain areas, you know, it's current arrangements are not particularly sustainable financially, nor administratively efficient. Can you pick maybe one of those three things that you sort of spoke to, either the road accident or health insurance, and maybe help us understand what some of those arrangements are right now and what they could look like when reformed in a better way?
Well, the road accident fund is the really big, unsustainable arrangement. Mm. So we inherit a system in which there's a fuel levy that goes to the road accident fund. It's a substantial part of the price you pay every time you fill up your foot a liter of petrol into your car. It's a fuel levy that we think of as a proxy tax that roughly corresponds with road usage and risks on the road, and it finances the benefits that the Road Accident Fund pays. And what the Road Accident Fund tries to pay on a fault basis, I'm going to get a bit technical here, it's a fault basis insurance system in which drivers are indemnified against the risk of causing injury to other people, other drivers or passengers or pedestrians. But if the other driver or pedestrian, think pedestrians misbehaving on a road or drunk on a road, if the other party is at fault, then there's a share of the risk and a share of the costs, or only a portion of the costs that may be paid out by the road accident fund. So this is a system that's built on, if you like, market-based insurance principles, but it's funded through a tax. And there's a whole legal process of dispute resolution, often through the courts, through which settlements are determined. So the outcome, this is when I talk about the administrative inefficiency of the system, the outcome is that a large share of the costs that tax, that fuel levy pays, go to pay lawyers, go to pay for the administration, both on the side of the Road Accident Fund itself, which has to pay its own lawyers and its own administrators and its assessors, and on the part of claimants. And that's a very time-consuming process. So a victim of a road accident who wants to make a claim against the Road Accident Fund can often wait 3 years, 5 years, 10 years before the matter gets settled. And the settlements are quite high. If you're a high-income earner and you're a claimant, then the possibility is there that you've lost your ability to earn an income, and so you can claim to offset that, and that can be quite a high, high claim. So the idea that the Satrell Commission recommended, and that has been under discussion now for 20 years, is that you move to limiting the benefits, making them fixed and determined in law, so there's much less dispute that has to go to courts, take away the fault requirement and make it a no-fault system that benefits people, pays for health costs, pays for remedial care, and hospital care where needed, without asking questions about who is at fault in what went wrong on the road, and recognizing that mistakes happen, accidents happen. Then you take away a large part of the administrative costs and you limit benefits and you create the space. And this is a point I make that is not much in the public domain. You create the space for people to insure themselves, if they wish to, against the costs that are not covered by the fund. So if you're a high income earner, you can take out life insurance, you can take out disability insurance, and you're not having to deal with those costs as part of the statutory system. Now, to get to the numbers, the Road Accident Fund funds itself through this levy. The levy doesn't pay for all the costs of every accident that happened every year. It just pays for what's needed when the claims happen, 5 years, 10 years late. And so when you do the actuarial arithmetic on the Road Accident Fund, and when I did this a year or two ago, the unfunded liability of the Road Accident Fund was over 300 billion rand. That's more than we spend on social grants in the budget. It's a phenomenally large unfunded debt, really, of a fund. The money's not been collected yet. The accidents have happened. The claims have still got to come through. The settlement has still got to be reached. So the cash maybe isn't needed yet, but it's still a liability. And it's growing very rapidly. So that's a big ticking time bomb in our public finance system. It's not part of the budget that the Minister of Finance takes to Parliament every year, but it's there as a liability of that as a consequence of what the law provides for. Well, if one doesn't deal with that kind of unfunded budget liability before it really blows out, then ultimately taxpayers are going to find themselves facing a large unexpected burden, and that really isn't a route we want to go on. That's partly why there's a fiscal reason. I think there's also a fairness reason. There's also an efficiency reason why one should take those recommendations for a road accident benefit scheme seriously. But it is a public finance issue that has to be addressed. So.
Yeah. No, I think I'll probably come back to this later, but I'll be interested to hear what it would take to get people to take these recommendations seriously and actually act on them, because 20 years is a very long time. And at this rate, you don't know if it would be next year or five more years. But I think one other thing I wanted to touch on was sort of around this topic of employment, which I particularly get excited about. And in your chapter, you wrote that while improved social insurance, for instance, could contribute to greater income security and poverty reduction, it cannot compensate for the main source of inequality and vulnerability in South Africa. Can you speak to us a bit about South Africa's attempts at these employment intensive sort of recoveries and the discussions around the idea of a basic income grant?
Well, we've seen the unemployment rate increase from 21-22% 12 or 13 years ago to over well over 30% now. And if you add in discouraged workers, it's 35 or 40%. So we have a huge unemployment problem. And I think that that has to be seen as the central social and economic challenge that we face. So currently, I mean, as we know, during the COVID times, we extended our social grant system. We introduced a new grant that provides 350 rand a month to claimants, to quite large numbers of claimants. And we're seeing this as a sort of substitute for employment. Well, I don't think it's a fiscally sustainable substitute. I think you've got to have a strategy for job creation. Yes, it's important to have grants and income support in place if you like to have some kind of unemployment insurance system that is broader than our present unemployment insurance system is placed. But it really would be a social and economic mistake to let the basic income grant idea replace or substitute for, in policy thinking, the challenge of dealing with the employment problem. And so I think that we have to build on the initiatives that have made progress in the last 20 years. Public employment programs have steadily increased the number of people who are working in municipalities in the presidential employment stimulus of the last 2 years, in schools as assistants, in to teachers and in providing sporting activities in the afternoon and improved security in schools. I think these are great programs that give opportunities to young people. They don't pay high wages, but they're a job, and for many young people, a first-time entry into the job market, an opportunity to learn about work experience and move on from there. If you don't give young people a work opportunity in the year or two after they leave school or after they leave further education, they become disenchanted, and the risks that they become dysfunctional in the labor market just become so much higher. So we need to find ways of accelerating our public employment programs. We need to find ways of making our economy more employment intensive. And so that means bringing more flexibility into labor markets, addressing the barriers to job creation in the private sector. And we need to find ways of encouraging the sectors that are more employment intensive, agriculture, but services especially. Services, and especially urban services, think restaurants, and tourism activities, home-based care. There are a wide range of services activities in which job creation potential is really greater than in the traditional industries, mining and manufacturing, in which it's hard to compensate, it's hard to offset the way in which technology change leads to machines replacing jobs. Economies, but our economy especially, needs to address its employment challenge. And I have some ideas about how to go about that. But in the context of the current
debate, some of them.
It's so important to get employment strategies at the top of the agenda, and not to think that we can simply put cash grants in place as an alternative. That's not going to solve the problem. I think the key policy initiative that I would like to see is an extension of our present youth employment incentive, which operates through the tax system. So firms that employ young people in their first jobs get a subsidy through the tax system for that, creating that job opportunity for young people. But that doesn't change the labor market enough. It doesn't change the general trade-off between capital and more employment-intensive economic activities. I think that that youth employment incentive should be a general wage incentive, should be a general subsidy that applies to all low-wage formal work, not just for the first year or two when you're a work seeker. So you recognize that we're an unequal society. You recognize that we're an economy in which unemployment is too high. Many people leave school without work-related skills, and you use the capacity of the tax system, the administrative capacity is particularly important here, of our well-functioning revenue service with its really important, well-established relationships between employers, businesses and firms, and the tax authority. You use that system to provide an ongoing subsidy to low-wage work. It operates in other countries in various ways. In the United States, yeah, it's a very important part of supplementing the earnings of low-wage workers, particularly in the services sector, mm-hmm, who get a credit from the federal government or from the American tax system. And I think, yeah, we should do something similar here.
No, that's it's a very interesting proposal. All right, so as we bring this chat to an end, Andrew, could you walk us briefly through some of those better choices, right, that you think are needed, especially as, you know, there are proposals for, you know, reform when it comes to social security, health financing and income support? Like, what are those key choices that you're proposing in this chapter?
Well, we do have systems modernization issues to address. So one important point that I do make in the chapter is that we've got to get on with the business of modernizing the systems through which the unemployment insurance arrangements work, making use of the revenue services administrative capacity to support the payment systems and the revenue collection of the unemployment insurance system. But really the two most important points I want to make here are about income support and investment in earnings opportunities, making sure that we accelerate job creation and we get that unemployment rate down. And to do so, yeah, it applies to pensions, it applies to disability insurance, it applies to the road accident benefit arrangements, and it applies to national health insurance. Make progress in modernizing and extending these arrangements to all in ways that take advantage of private sector capacity. Don't try to build the systems entirely within the state. Recognize that we have well-established medical schemes, a large private health industry that can be a partner in extending health insurance and medical services to all. So it's about partnerships. It's about really building structured arrangements in the law, yeah, and in contractual arrangements, and in the regulatory framework that governs health services, life insurance and pension arrangements, and the road accident benefit system. In all of these areas, governments can work together with the private sector more effectively than we do at present.
Andrew, thank you so much. But before you go, I have to ask, what was the most surprising thing when you were doing the research for this chapter?
This is an area, been an area of interest for me for a long time. So surprises go back quite a while. So I'm going to answer your question in a slightly oblique way, because I worked on some of these issues in government for many years, one surprising thing out of that experience was about just how hard it is to get the officials who are responsible for delivering services. Think of the operations of the Compensation Fund or the Road Accident Fund Administration or the Unemployment Insurance Fund or the Department of Social Development delivering social grants to work together on new institutional arrangements. And the reason for that is that, you know, you're so busy trying to do the job that you're responsible for, that it's really hard to think about changing arrangements in ways that also take on the different administrative arrangements of other systems and the possibility of collaborating in simple things like how you go about what the criteria are for measuring and registering disability. So there are different systems that apply in the Road Accident Fund from those that apply in our occupational injury system. Just standardizing and harmonizing those arrangements would go a long way towards achieving greater administrative efficiency in those systems. But it's hard to get officials to work together in that way because it's a bit of a distraction from the day-to-day responsibility that are on your desk. That's a slightly unfair response to your question. Maybe it's not a surprise, but getting institutions to work together effectively is harder than we think. It takes.
I think that's a really good point, and it's one of the areas I'm quite interested in. Because you know, personally, I'm just sort of trying to figure out some discussions around, you know, this thing of political will to do things, what exactly that means and what that means for trying to get things done. But anyway, back to what you just said, are there some ways that you've seen this work well? So when have they been able to work well? Does it usually depend on the people in charge? Because I think sometimes that's when it gets challenging. If it becomes about a person, then if the person is not there anymore, then we have issues. Or are there particular structures that have existed in certain parts that have allowed them to work together with other institutions better? I'm just wondering if you have any ideas around when things have worked well and how maybe we may be able to replicate some of these things in terms of getting institutions to work together. That's just me being nosy at this point.
Sometimes a crisis is what it takes. So I did have the privilege of working a bit with the Unemployment Insurance Fund and representatives of the businesses involved in making claims from the Unemployment Insurance Fund during the COVID period when we introduced the temporary employer-employee relief scheme. So the TERS benefit that the UIF paid for ended up transferring something like 60 billion rand from the Unemployment Insurance Fund to workers who lost their jobs or found their work considerably curtailed during the COVID lockdown periods. And it was really hard work, large numbers of people working long hours to get those arrangements in place so that those payments could happen. It took longer than it should. There was a lot of argument. There were a lot of systems that didn't work well at first and had to be revised and reformed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, the cash flowed. Lots of businesses were kept going who otherwise would have gone under. And workers had a bit of supplement to their incomes during really difficult times. And sometimes it takes a crisis to really get those efforts and collaboration going that allow progress to be made in building better systems.
Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to do this with me. This has been fantastic.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.